I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour writes, in the wake of the Great Recession, the country is seeing the emergence of toxic inequality, an unprecedented convergence of historic and rising levels of wealth and income inequality, stalled social mobility, and a widening racial wealth gap. It results from the rules and choices that structure America's economy. We can produce a more equitable society, and we'll talk about how we can do that this hour. Our guest is Professor Thomas Shapiro. He's a professor of law and sociology at Brandeis University and is author of Toxic Inequality, How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. He's come up with, it was published in the Boston Globe, 7 ideas of ways to address this very important issue. And I thought we'd go through some of them. They're very interesting, and I think they'll provoke some phone calls on your part. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Tom Shapiro, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, good afternoon. Hi. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, our pleasure. We have so much to talk about. I think this idea of the book, I mean, it's amazing because you did essentially a 20-year study. Please tell us, you interviewed people 20 years ago, you went back to see how they're doing, and thus the book, the genesis of the book. What were you looking at?
Well, it seems like it took 20 years. So I was really lucky in that the team I was working with was able to interview nearly 200 families back in 1990, starting in 1998. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to look at families that were about half of whom were white, the other half African-American or Hispanic, half middle class, half working class or poor, half in an urban area and half in a suburban area of those same surroundings. All families needed to have young children about 5 years old. So the families were thinking about school decisions, community decisions, where they were going to live, what kind of housing, what their job and peer networks were going to look like. And central to all this was looking at how their family finances, their income and their wealth, help shape their decisions and their plans and their strategies. And I had, Kathleen, I had no idea that 12 years later I would be really fortunate and have the resources to follow those same families up. So I wrote a book called The Hidden Cost of Being African American that was published in 2004. And that was the result of the first set of interviews and other systematic data as well. Mm-hmm. But 12 years later, from the first interviews in 2010, 2011, even some up until 2012, we were able to reconnect with about 85% of the original set of families and see what had happened in their lives. And, of course, the Great Recession, unfortunately, had happened in late 2007 and created a lot of havoc on family plans and aspirations. And we were able to look, among other things, at what happened with the mobility of their the economic mobility of their children, who were 5 years old when we first interviewed the families, and if they had stayed on track, would have been high school seniors or in college, planning for college, or had dropped out by then. And that's the entire setup of the main set of data for the book Toxic Inequality. Mm-hmm. And I would just say that that set of data tells us, it doesn't tell us patterns, it doesn't tell us a national story. I use other more systematic survey data to get at the larger patterns and the larger stories, and then use the families to help us understand how the families are making decisions, why they were making the decisions they were making, and what the impact of large events are on family life.
Yeah. Let's talk about this whole issue, because I don't think it's discussed very much. The families who have access to asset wealth, who are able to overcome some setbacks and then pass on that status to their children. What is this asset wealth? Who has it? Who doesn't?
Well, unfortunately, we're talking about net financial wealth. So we're talking about everything that we own that has financial value minus all of our debts. And most American families don't have very much. Most American families don't have $5,000 or $6,000 squirreled away in a bank account or in stocks or bonds. We know, for example, that the distribution of wealth in American society is extremely lopsided and top heavy, such that the wealthiest 1% of Americans own 42% of all of our financial wealth, and that lopsidedness has been increasing at the very top, such that the bottom, and I would put bottom in air quotes because it's bottom 90%, 90% is not a bottom. But over the last two decades, the wealth of the 90% that includes, you know, probably 100% of us in our audience today has not grown, and that's part of the landscape, if you will, of toxic inequality. So families that are fortunate enough to have emergency savings, or enough to tide them over a prolonged period of unemployment, or not having health insurance or not having enough insurance to cover everything that's needed, or your car axle breaks in the winter in Wisconsin ice storms. Those are the families whose hard-earned mobility over a lot of years and the hard-earned work, those kinds of mishaps and personal and health crises can throw families off track way too easily.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you've got some financial assets set aside, or it's been passed along to you, you're able to navigate that territory a lot easier and not get thrown off track.
Mm-hmm. So how do we, I found the article you wrote in the Boston Globe very interesting, that you come up with some ideas of how to make sure that people are able to weather those storms that you just outlined and then some, that there are some steps actually that we can take, so in starting when we're babies.
Yeah, so one, it's a proposal by some really close colleagues of mine. Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton have been proposing this. And it's a program called Baby Bonds. And we actually have a little experience with it in the United Kingdom, but let's talk about it in the United States. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that at birth, through a combination of public and private, philanthropic, maybe community resources, an account or a bond would be set up for the newborn. And there's a miniature program like this, if you will, in the city of Oakland, where a child, I'm not sure whether it's at birth or when they enter kindergarten, there are two programs where they can have like $600 set aside in a program for them, the idea of which is that grows over time through sort of natural interest, compound interest. A summer employer can add to it, a family can add to it, the community of Oakland can add to it after elementary school graduation, so that the account grows enough so that by the time that a person becomes a young adult, they could use to help defer the robust expenses of higher education, whether that's college, community college, or skill development. And the whole idea there is to close the gap, and close the gap that makes college and higher education look like a great but lofty, but a goal that's really not meetable.
Mm-hmm.
By the current family finances. And it's to provide the aspiration and inspiration that, yes, it might be possible, and here's something that we all can put together, whether it's public, private, family, to help make that happen.
Would that be a really hard thing for us to do, for communities to do, if we did it on a federal level and said, hey, every baby who gets born gets $1,000?
Well, I would personally love to see that. I think the reality is in the current political environment,
right,
and it wasn't a whole lot different in the Obama administration, so we sort of need to be true about that,
right,
as well. We've not seen action at the federal level. And let's remember that also under the Obama administration, Republicans controlled both houses of Congress, so it was very contentious.
Mm-hmm.
But we have seen 100 flowers, if not 1,000 flowers, bloom in municipalities and states. So the state of Maine has a children's savings account where every child at birth automatically gets some money put into account. Mm. In the state of Nevada, and we're not talking about deep blue states here, understand.
Right.
In the state of Nevada, through its treasurer's office, has a program. It's not as quite as robust as what I mentioned in Oakland or as Maine in terms of the money, but it's also a children's savings account. The city of San Francisco has probably the most well-known one. It's called K2C, Kindergarten to College, where the city treasurer puts in for every child in enrolled in San Francisco. I think it's just public school. I don't know whether it's parochial and private or not, frankly. A small amount of money, which also can grow over time and be added to. And we're starting to see some results from that program. And the results we're seeing is the increased family sense that higher education actually lies in their child's future. And it's tied to financial education, financial literacy, and a number of other aspects that make that aspiration much more concrete, and produces what's called a college-bound identity, both for the family and the child. So it's not just the money, the research tells us, but it's the psychological identity of, I'm going to college.
Right. What a great program. I knew nothing about it.
And there are others
right.
like it. I live in Boston, and the city of Boston just started one.
Hmm.
I know that people in Wisconsin have been talking about it. I don't think it's gotten off the ground yet.
Mm-hmm.
The state of Illinois is about, I think, to pilot a demonstration children's savings account program in one or two cities, and if that's successful, the idea is that then it could be scaled to other parts
right.
of the state.
Well, let's go back to what you said just a little while ago, because it sort of makes you pause. It really makes you pause. When you talk about the 1% of people who own all this wealth, this huge amount of money, which seems to me to be something that that everybody should be asking about. You know, how can this be? What do you do with that kind of money? How can you have a situation where there's this huge inequality and it creates very difficult lives for so many people? African American, we finally found out that there are white people who are having a lot of angst and problems getting jobs, and it, you know, tilted an election a certain way if the Russians didn't do the rest. You know, there are these profound things that are going on, and everybody just, not everybody, some people rail against it, and others say, well, you know, that's the way it is. But it's because of what you just said that we have all of these other issues, isn't it?
I think that's a great question, and it's a great way of beginning to frame that conversation. People may remember, no matter what you thought of the tactics, but the movements around Wall Street
right.
That spread to other parts of the country that talked about the top 1% and the rest of us, the other 99%, and that really was an attempt to focus some kind of public attention around the escalating, rapidly escalating wealth gap in the United States of extreme wealth, and it's stagnating for the most of the rest of us. You know, Kathleen, I think it's true. I know it's true that most other countries in the world have experienced as much prosperity as the United States, and I point to all of Europe. For example, and other countries, some of the new economies, if you will, that have done very well in terms of their economic growth and their wealth growth, but they've done it in a way where the distribution of that wealth is not nearly as lopsided as it is in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So the United States, both our wealth and income inequality are at historic highs. And this takes us back right before the Great Depression era, the late 1920s in the United States. Our wealth inequality is not only at historic highs, it's also higher than any other Western, democratic, market-oriented society, and many of the non-Western societies as well. And the data is abundantly clear about that. So I think the question becomes, what is it in the rules and regulations and policy of our economy and our market that has advantaged those kinds of wealthy powers as much as it has.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I point to that a little bit in the book. I think, frankly, someone like Joseph Stiglitz, an award-winning economist, really tells that story extremely well in some of his recent books, including the one called The Price of Inequality, where we can, you know, he lays bare how some lobbyists and corporate interests have really taken control of the rules of the market and bent it in a direction. And, you know, I think one example that might be known and or resonate with our listeners today is the way that the federal government, through laws that are passed because of lobbyists, large federal organizations cannot bargain for drugs and the price of drugs with large pharmaceutical companies to pass those savings along to those of us involved in that kind of health care.
Right.
It's prohibited. Right. By legislation that's passed at the behest of the pharmaceutical companies. And that's why I think that's a prime reason why almost all pharmaceutical drugs are so much more costly in the United States, where the exact same drug is much less costly in the rest of the world.
Yeah, just one of a number of things that you put up your hands
and say,
what?
That's just an example, yeah.
Right. The other thing that happens is once you've got that kind of wealth, let's just talk about inherited wealth for a moment. If you're in that, not even upper 1%, but if you're doing pretty well, your kids go to very good schools, you have more money spent in a wider variety of courses. You've got a lot of people who go to colleges that cost a lot of money, and you don't have to worry about how much money it is you're going to pay to go to college. And then you just perpetuate the kind of life that you grew up in. Whereas other people who don't have all of that have got all these difficulties to overcome, don't they?
I think absolutely. I think there's a, if you will, an ecology of advantage and disadvantage, and the way that advantage in particular is passed along is through financial wealth of families and direct inheritance, and, which includes helping a first-time homeowner, having their parents help them with sort of substantial support to help them on the down payment. To pay for some or all of pretty hefty tuition costs, so that their children come out with little student debt or no student debt. Those are the ways that financial advantage is passed along from generation to generation. Now, having said that, most American families don't inherit much at all. The data I look at tells me that only about 4 of 10 American families can really count or have inherited an amount of money that might make a difference at all. And among that 40% or so, the prevalence rate is that African-American, the white families inherit 8 times more often than African-American families do. And among those that inherit, you know, the few African-Americans in the relatively, you know, small of us white families that are able to inherit, African Americans inherit $30,000 less. So on the advantage side, the ecology of advantage, that's how advantage is transmitted, and opportunities are transmitted. You know, in one way, some of us think that we like to work hard because we want to be able to do the best we possibly can for our children. You know, and I've got a 28-year-old, and I want him to do as well as he possibly can, and help him, you know, whatever he can take in some ways from me. But at the same time, we have to recognize the conflict in our that's core to our values. You cannot have huge amounts of inheritance and equal opportunity at the same time, because a huge amount of inheritance means that somebody is given second, third, fourth chances, where somebody without that's got one shot at it. If they fail, it's really hard for them to get back on track.
And to go into another area, which I know that you've written about, you can't have high levels of residential segregation and have an equal society, can you?
It's a really complicated area. I would say, you know, the quick answer is yes. and now, you know, I think it's important to layer and nuance that a little bit. In many of our Midwestern and Northern cities, I'm in Boston, people in Milwaukee, Chicago, Peoria, Detroit, our levels of occupational segregation, that is, communities that are still largely color-coded, has persisted for a long period of time. Some of the newer cities, the newer growing cities in particular, we've been seeing much more progress in terms of occupational segregation levels have declined, and we've been making some progress on that. Now, part of the impact of that for the wealth conversation and wealth inequality conversation that we're having today is a very profound impact, and it happens in the following way. If you and I, or you or I, own a home in a relatively homogeneous, let's say, white community, the exact same home, the exact same architecture, built in the same year, the same number of blades of grass and square footage, everything as equal as we could make it. If that same home were in a community that is not homogeneous white, much less a fully inclusive, much less a community that is dominated by minority home ownership, the home value is much less. Mm-hmm. And the equity, that is the rise in home value over time, happens much less in communities that are not homogeneous and middle class and white. And that's primarily how wealth is created in the United States. You know, kind of an interesting a little smoking gun figure for me is that a lot of us presume, as this old story in Economics 101 tells us, that wealth is the product of our thrift and our savings, the money that we don't spend out of our paychecks, that we invest wisely, and we'll sprinkle in a little luck. Well, that's a nice story, and for some families it resonates, and that actually is the case. But it's a pretty small number. Two-thirds of the wealth of America's broad middle class, and I mean that by 60% of the population, two-thirds of our wealth is in our home equity. It's not in our savings account. It's not produced out of what we scrimped and saved and were thrifty about. Mm-hmm. It's produced through the institutional mechanism of home ownership and where those homes are located. And that loops us right back to residential segregation.
Yeah. Well, we're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Thomas Shapiro. He's a professor of law and sociology at Brandeis University and the author of Toxic Inequality, How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter. And that's at K Dunn Show. Here are some ideas that he and his colleagues have worked on. We already talked about this baby bond idea, which is interesting. I didn't realize it was in play in so many different cities. Leveling the education playing field. Property taxes are the primary source for local funding for public schools, so richer districts have more money, and poorer districts are strapped for resources. There are some states that have done something to try and change that formula. Should we do that all over the country? We should cap mortgage write-offs. We can talk about that in more detail, and we will offer universal retirement accounts. Low-income families are less likely to have access to workplace retirement accounts. Launch universal pre-K, good evidence that early childhood education could help eliminate the achievement gap between socioeconomic groups. So some of the areas we're going to, and we welcome you to come along with us with your active participation. All right, let's go to some phone calls for our guest, Thomas Shapiro. His book is Toxic Inequality, How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. We go to John in Shell Lake for our first call. Hi, John.
How are you doing?
All right, John, how are you?
I'm well.
Good.
I guess I was listening to your speaker opening up your show, and he was talking about how people are held back by their neighborhoods or racial ethnicity and all this kind of thing. And I grew up in Milwaukee, which is a city that he mentioned. And when I grew up back in the 50s and 60s there, every neighborhood was segregated, and they were not by black or white or Hispanic, but the Polish had a neighborhood, the Germans had a neighborhood, the Jewish were on the east side, the Italians were on the near north side. And nobody crossed many lines, you know, for decades and decades. And when the Irish came here, the Polish came here, they were discriminated against, held back, took minimum wage jobs. They struggled and they did what they needed to do to gain a little bit at a time through generation after generation. And I guess the problem that I have with that is to think that anybody, because they're black or Hispanic or whatever, is being held back because they're held in a neighborhood, I think there comes a time when they have to own up to the fact that they may have to take a minimum wage job and their kids get a little better job or they work their way up. Nobody started out getting upper middle class wages.
Yeah, but our point, part of what we've been seeing is that some people are starting out with pretty much a guaranteed upper middle class life because you're going to get it from your family.
Exactly, but their family built it up through generations, and they started out at minimum wage jobs. I don't care whether they were Jewish or Polish or Norwegian or whatever they were. When they first came here and when they first started out, they were discriminated against. They were held into certain neighborhoods where they felt comfortable and or what they could afford.
Yeah. All right, Tom, response.
So, you know, I think at its heart, John really does pose a classic question that we talk about a lot in the social sciences and in public policy. And it's the question of looking at kind of successive ethnic generations and communities in the United States and how it is that some ethnic communities tended to do fairly well in terms of where they started from in relationship to where they are today, and to understand how that might have happened, and compare that or contrast that with some of the newer immigrant communities, if you will, and with the longstanding African American communities, and try and help us figure out why the same thing doesn't seem to have happened. I think it's a long story, but let me try and truncate it a little bit here. John rightly is talking, he referenced the 1950s, for example. I think that's a great era to talk about. We could go back to the 40s, 30s, and even up until the 1960s. From the end of World War II, 1945, until 1970 or so, America was really fortunate and experienced an incredible period of growth and prosperity. Quite literally, the living standard for almost every group in the United States doubled. Wherever they were at the end of World War II until the beginning of the 1970s, whether it was men or women, whether it was black, white, Hispanic, Polish, Italian, Irish, middle class, working class, standard of living for all of us nearly doubled, some more than others for sure. But that era ended. That era ended in 1970. And that era happened between the end of World War II and the beginning of 1970s, I don't know John's or his family's story, but it might be one where even somebody without a higher education, fancy college degree, could have walked into a steel mill or an auto plant in Racine and earned a really good salary. And that salary also came with benefits, paid sick leave, maybe even some retirement savings account that the company might have matched, a pension system, if you will. And workers in that era that tended to be the ethnic workers that John referenced did relatively well. And that's I think that's a great story, and it's a model story. However, African Americans tended to be excluded both from those kinds of quality jobs to a greater extent than others were, and Latinos and Hispanics also were excluded. So as the Latino population grew much more recently, post-1970s, and as many of the racial barriers were knocked down with civil rights legislation only in the 1960s, African Americans couldn't own property in many states until the mid-1960s, at least not legally, and still were prohibited from many jobs, both by, if not by law, then by custom. So my point here is that African Americans and Hispanics in particular enter the labor market in large numbers at a point in time where our prosperity has stalled. The growth has not stalled, but the wealth that it's created now is no longer being distributed somewhat equitably among all groups that produce things, but it's going to the very top. And that's where you see where we begin to see the great gap, the great difference between successive ethnic generations prior to the 1970s coming through a labor market that was able to reward them, and through some union jobs, frankly, that was able to reward them as well, and later groups that entered because of legal or custom or Jim Crow restrictions, and more recent immigrants come of age in the United States in a very different era.
Yeah.
I think that's a large part of the story.
Right. It's a long legacy. Race has a horrible dark shadow in this country, and you can't look at this issue without looking at the legacy of race in America, a civil war, lynchings. You have to have legislation. You've got Jim Crow, and on it goes and on it goes for hundreds of years.
So that's absolutely right. And, you know, I would let's reference something a little more contemporary, because the legacy is really important. I'm not going to dismiss it by any stretch of the imagination, because it's all a continual legacy in a lot of ways. But let's look at something that continues to have an impact today, and that is the Social Security system.
Oh, yes.
When Social Security is introduced and passed in 1934 and 1935, for the first time in the midst of a Great Depression in the United States, many people, historians, will tell us that it passed, and part of the deal it passed on was that to get the support of Southern Democratic senators, certain occupations had to be excluded, and those were the occupations of railroad workers, domestic workers, and farm workers. That is, occupations that were largely workers of color, particularly African Americans and Hispanics in the agricultural area. So we have this incredibly robust and I think very progressive Social Security system that provides a baseline, a floor for retirement and disability, and for the children of workers who've passed away way too young out of illness or industrial accident. That I think it's a great system. I really do. But large swaths of African Americans and Hispanics were excluded from that system right from the beginning, and only became added as the system was reformed in the 1960s and 50s and up until the 1970s, when agricultural workers and some domestic workers and others were brought in, so that even today, if people are old enough, they're African American and Hispanic workers that receive a lot less from Social Security because, quote, their work didn't count.
Oh, interesting.
And so that's how that legacy
right.
lives.
John, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to David in Green Bay next. Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got three sons, two with college degrees, four-year degrees, and one in the trade. The problem in a lot of our, say, where I live in Green Bay, there's a lot of paper mills. So the wages used to be you could go into those paper mills, like your guest said, and within a few months you'd be up to good pay and on your way. Now it's $11 an hour, and you got to jump through all kinds of hoops, and you make one mistake, and it takes you 3 to 4 years to get up to anything like $16 an hour.
Uh-huh.
My oldest son actually has like 5-6 years of schooling, making $14 an hour. You know, there's so many college graduates out there that their wages are really in the pooper. And I look around at a lot of these younger people that I talk to, and I'm really fearful for the future because I'm ready to step out. I'm 61. I've been driving a truck for 40 years. But I'll tell you what, it's a tough slug for these young people today. And even if you get a job, you're only as good as what you did today. There's no job security anywhere.
Right.
Yeah,
and
David, I think that's a, thank you for bringing that up. I think that's a jewel of a point.
Mm-hmm.
David was maybe coming of age in the 1970s, I don't know how, David, but he said he was 61.
61, yeah.
The largest employer in the United States in 1970 was General Motors, that employed about a little over 500,000 workers. Many of whom were union workers, earned a decent wage in the paycheck, but also had those benefits, or what we would call employment capital, that protected them from mishaps, like paid sick leave, like contribution to health and dental, and some pension or retirement system. Today, the largest employer in the United States is Walmart, 1.4 million American employees.
Wow.
Most of whom are earning around the poverty level, and as we know from other studies, the public, the government subsidizes some of those salaries because they're so low, and that for me captures some of the transition in the employment landscape in the United States. I have a 28-year-old as well, also a college graduate. Currently, he's got a job he really likes. I won't say what it is. But it doesn't pay a whole lot. He and his friends, who are also pretty highly educated, even if they're working at jobs that pay them a decent wage, they're not happy. They're finding very little, if no identity, in the kind of work they do. And I think part of what I and David are talking about relates back to how jobs have changed so much over the last 30 and 50 years.
And the number of young people who have to work more than one job, Tom, too. There are lots of those people.
There are. You know, in the book, I cite one piece of data that I keep looking at it, and I keep asking, is this really right? And go back to the source, and it always comes out right, unfortunately. And that's a piece of data when you're asking the question of what are the work hours in a family, not an individual. But the work hours in a family. American families are working 11% more work hours today than we did 30 years ago.
Goodness.
And that translates into like several more weeks a year. And that's because, yes, more partners are working for pay than before. But it's also that second and third job. And it's also, you know, I think grown and adult children or near adult children also helping the family out.
David,
That's a way American families have been resilient and are compensating for stalled mobility and stagnated living standards. We're working more hours to stay in the same spot.
Mm-hmm. David, thanks for your call. Bob in Madison, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
I would just really love to add to all this. I had the opportunity to stay with my parents kind of as what you would define as a boomerang kid, okay?
Yeah.
But I went to college. I did all the stuff. I got a degree, and I went to a nice college, you know, but I was lucky enough to get out with any debt. And I think all this institutional green crap and the stuff that they're feeding these kids in college, it makes them not want to really work anymore. And, you know, everybody thinks that they got to have something. They got to have an iPhone. They got to have this. They got to have a brand new car. It's not going to happen, people. You got to work. You have to work. And if you don't want to work, well, I mean, and I know that there's no jobs out there that are paying, but you that's why you're going to have to go back home, and you're going to have to make some money in order to get established somewhere and go buy a house or be able to rent. I mean, our society is screwed up.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. I think there's a big kernel of truth there. I don't know if you have grown children or not. Mine and the friends in his circle, and you know, I'm privileged. I teach at a university. I teach graduate students. I teach undergraduates, and they're on me all the time about summer jobs and internships, and you know what's happening with work after college. And almost all of them, they want to earn a decent paycheck. And it might be because they've got a student debt to pay to get through this place, like other universities. But they also want there's also a sense of purpose that they're looking for. They're looking for community. They're looking for the kind of work where they feel that they might be doing some good for mankind, for the environment, for production, as well as earning a paycheck, and that's tough. Bob mentioned Boomerang Kids. One of the interesting sort of novel findings of the family that I took from the families that we interviewed in the book, it occurred among some of the African American families, where when we would ask them the story of how did you buy your first home. And these are families, and when we first interviewed them in 98, late 20s, early to mid-30s,
mm-hmm.
A couple of the African-American families told us, well, when we first got married, we moved back in with our parents.
Mm.
And not because we couldn't afford it, but because we made a plan with my parents. And the plan was we move back in, you know, into the spare bedroom or the basement or wherever it is. We don't pay rent. But we're going to put that money into a bank account, and we're going to escrow it, and that's going to become our down payment cash for to buy that first home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a different sense of boomerang. It's more of a jettison or springboard strategy. And that strategy occurred a little differently among the white families where the financial help was a little more direct.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was sort of a really interesting, mm-hmm. resilient way to navigate.
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Thomas Shapiro is our guest this hour. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. He is the author of Toxic Inequality, How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. He's a professor of law and sociology at Brandeis University. Thanks for your call, Bob. Our number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network. Let's go to more phone calls. Corey in Holman is next. Hi, Corey.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Okay, how are you?
How are you, Corey?
Well, pretty fantastic.
All right.
Go ahead.
I just, you know, I've been thinking about this for a little while, and I just like the opinion of your guest there. And I'm not quite sure if this is kind of a crazy idea or anything like that, but what if they made a law prohibiting people from having children unless they fill out a form, you know, stating that they have enough income for it, that they're in a stable situation.
So we should stop people from having children because they don't have enough money. Tom.
Yeah, no, he's right. It's a crazy idea.
Right.
And you know, unfortunately, Corey, I don't think very highly of it. We have a really bad historical precedent around that in the United States, and it's called the eugenics movement. It's a movement that was very strong in the United States and in Germany in the 1930s that essentially had it was passage of laws in Indiana, North Carolina, and other states. They were passed at state levels that would literally sterilize females and sometimes males who they deemed could not be appropriate parents. And at that point in time, being deemed not an appropriate parent was often a misdiagnosed educational deficiency or some other so-called disability, where really it was the lack of income and what authorities felt was sort of the low culture. The eugenics movement in the United States focused primarily on very poor white women and women of color. And we see there was a famous Supreme Court case called Bell versus, I think it was the state of North Carolina, if I'm remembering it right, where one of the judges said something like three generations of imbeciles is enough, and you know, allowed an institution to sterilize the plaintiff in the court at that point in time. That's pretty drastic, obviously. But that's a historical precedent, and I think no matter how we frame the capacity of individuals to have and raise children is a very, very slippery slope that too often lands us in periods around ethnic cleansing, Nazi Germany, and sterilizing poor white women and women of color in the United States.
You've given that call more attention than it deserved. Let's go to some of these other ideas. Capping mortgage write-offs. This is interesting. Mortgage and property tax deductions primarily subsidize the wealthiest households. They get the highest tax deductions for housing, but they don't necessarily need those, right? Other people could use those.
Absolutely. So I would frame it this way. We invest as a society in a public good called called home ownership. I would prefer it be housing security, but we currently frame a public good as home ownership, and we invest as a public close to $200 billion a year, according to which estimate you really want to believe here. And most of that is the mortgage interest deduction. If you're a homeowner like I am and millions of others, we are allowed through the tax structure as a tax subsidy to take whatever tax bracket we're in off of the interest we pay on the mortgage if our individual expenses are large enough to allow us to do that. That's how there literally is a federal public subsidy for home ownership in the United States. Now, it's one thing to think about a pot of $200 billion a year, which is a lot of money, let's stipulate that, and think about how we could spend it for home ownership and housing security and affordable housing in the United States. It's another thing to understand what the real fact and distribution of that $200 billion is. One estimate, which I think is really right on, tells us that 86% of that $200 billion goes to the wealthiest 10%. Now, that's not a policy direction that we want to go as a society. That actively has policy in the government redistributing wealth to the top. Now, there's some pretty easy fixes to that. We could cap the mortgage interest deduction. We could make it flat. We could include renters. There are a lot of real easy policy fixes. The problem, of course, is the, I don't want to say lack of political will, but it's the very powerful banking and mortgage broker lobbying efforts and the home builder home efforts that keep the present system intact. Now, just one last fact,
yes.
if you don't mind, because
no,
I think that
sure.
The comparative figure is real interesting here. If we were to take a survey of your very bright and very well-informed audience, because they listen to this show, I would nonetheless wager some amount of money that most people would say the housing policy of the United States is what? And the answer would be subsidized housing, rental subsidies, housing projects, because that's what's on the public mind. We spend as a society a large amount of money on that, about $40 billion a year. But we spend five times as much money of public funds invested in home ownership for families that probably don't need it.
We're thinking about. All right, let's go to Jim in Wanakee next. Hi, Jim.
Okay, I know we're about out of time, so just really quickly, I was going to mention that the system, I'm not real hopeful about the system because of the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, where you've got all these wealthy people, that people that have the wealth are able to unduly influence, like, for instance, in Wisconsin, the race between Feingold and Johnson. Well, Feingold worked very hard, but he was outspent five times. He was in the lead for a long time.
All right, money in all of this. We have about 30 seconds, Tom.
Sure, no, that Jim is absolutely right. And, you know, for me, the problem, there's a twin problem with Citizens United. One is, you know, the ability of corporations to be defined as individuals and have the same kinds of rights in that area is, I think, you know, just really horrific. Show me the birth certificate of a corporation. It's not the same. It's not the freedom of speech that individuals that we have enshrined in a great constitution. The second problem, very quickly, is that it shields from transparent public understanding of who those donors are.
Yeah, and on that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you very much, Tom, for being with us.
I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Kathleen.
Yeah, Thomas Shapiro, professor of law and sociology at Brandeis University, author of Toxic Inequality, How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. Thanks to Marika Saval for producing this hour and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production. Next with you on Monday for all things political. A lot to talk about, and also the author of the New York Times Sunday Magazine forthcoming this Sunday. Should be good shows on Monday.